Welcome to Island Cabin Discs on Interlochen Public Radio. This is the program that features the people you know about, sharing the music they would take with them to a deserted island getaway in the middle of Lake Michigan. I'm Jeff Kimpton, your host, and my guest today is Paula Robeson, internationally acclaimed flutist, currently on the faculty at New England Conservatory. Welcome, Paula, to the island.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you here. Even though we're in our studio, we're going to pretend we're on the island here. So here at Interlochen for Summer Institute, and so it's great to grab you into the studio for this program. We always ask our guests the same question. We asked you to be on the program. What went through your mind as you had to look at this amazing career you've had in music, and how could you possibly choose five pieces?
Thank you for saying that.
What happened?
I had heard through my whole life about the list of what you would take onto a desert island, and I always hoped that no one would ever ask me what I would take, because I love so much, many different kinds of music. And then when you described further what it was, that it wasn't a little island with just one palm tree on it, but it was an island in the middle of Lake Michigan, that changed the whole thing. And there's a cabin there. And because I love being in nature so much, that's one of the reasons I love being here at Interlochen, because of music, the nature is all around. Then it started becoming quite appealing.
Right.
In fact, the idea of going there and being there was very appealing.
And then you didn't hold back, because the list is
<That's>
the list you brought is quite extensive. So this is a 12-hour program here today.
Paula's marathon list.
But what's interesting, and you're the first person of the 100 and some programs we've done here, who said you would arrive on the island and you would not listen to music. You would listen to?
Exactly, to nature.
Right.
I would love to, upon my arrival, just set foot on this island and just listen to the wind, listen to the water, listen to the birds who are my teachers and my friends and my family. I live for their sound. I love listening to them. So I think a good part of my first listening experience there would be listening to them, to my friends, the birds. And I thought when you asked me this of a poem by William Butler Yeats, who's one of my very, very favorite poets. And so would it be too over the top to read the poem?
Absolutely. I think birds and nature sounds go right with poetry. So take it away.
Okay. It's called The Lake Isle of Innisfree. I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there, of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace here, for peace comes dripping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore, while I stand by the roadway or on the pavement gray. I hear it in the deep heart's core. So I've thought so often of that poem when I'm in the city and in an airport.
Yep.
I will arise and go now. And here you've given me my chance.
That's right.
I can go now.
That's right. And there's music and poetry and in nature. And of course, it's a huge motivator for so much musical composition to begin with. So
yes, absolutely.
Very appropriate. But now the sun is falling. It's cocktail time. And you do have to pick out some music. And you went right to some Brazilian music.
That's right. I love Brazilian music. And I love bossa nova music. I love choro music. I play a lot of Brazilian music with choro, kind of the folk and urban folk music, which led into samba and then into bossa nova in the 50s. And so in the 60s, as a young person, started hearing João Gilberto singing. And he would sing in a whisper and just play his guitar. And he'd be singing his most marvelous, often very complex poems about longing and about something called saudade, which is a Portuguese word, a Brazilian word. There's no kind of word for it in English. It's kind of like Well, Debussy got it in his music. It's kind of, you don't know whether to be happy or sad. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of longing for something you don't even understand what it is. Mm-hmm. Sort of like the blues, like,
right?
You know, but it's
not as explicit as the blues.
Yeah,
right.
Not, yeah. Because it's very, yeah, ambiguous and very sexy. So I'd listen to him first.
Olha que coisa mais linda, mais cheia de graça. Ela, menina que vem e que passa, num doce balanço, caminho do mar. Moça do corpo dourado, do sol de Ipanema, o seu balançado é mais que um poema. É a coisa mais linda que eu já vi passar. Estou tão sozinho. Ah, porque tudo é tão triste. Ah, a beleza que existe. A beleza que não é só minha, que também passa sozinha. Ah, se ela soubesse que quando ela passa, o mundo sorrindo se enche de graça e fica mais lindo por causa do amor. She passes, each one she passes goes, ah.
She walks to the sea. She looks straight ahead, not at me.
Well, that's the first musical selection, well, recorded musical selection. We've already had wonderful musical poetry and musical nature sounds, but of our guest today, Paula Robeson, international flutist, flute performer here on our campus at Interlochen this summer, and the great music of Jobim and the great performance of Gilberto. So does it put you in the mood?
Oh, yes. I'm glad to be here.
That's great. So the flute, and the flute for such a distinguished career for so long. How'd you start the flute? I mean, were there early experiences? Was it something you heard once and you saw it and identified, or?
Well, my mother was an actor, so there was a theater, very strong theater strain in my family. My father was a writer, but he loved music. His whole family was full of music. His family life was full of music when he was young. He always had wanted to be a conductor, so he was always conducting to Toscanini recordings. And they started me with the piano, but it was just kind of too big for me, and it had all these, so big, and I was kind of overwhelmed by it. So they used to say they never would be able to tell I had any musical talent whatsoever from my piano playing. But then, before I was born, actually, my father heard a recording of the great French flutist Marcel Moïse playing the Mozart Concerto in D major. This was a recording that was made in the 30s. And he always had in his ear that sound of the flute as Moïse played it, which was so full of life. And he saw this young girl. I was about 11 years old then. He thought, maybe the flute. And there was a great school music program in the California schools at that time. I was just going into junior high school, and there was a beginning winds class. Mm-hmm. A friend loaned me a flute. She gave me this flute. I picked it up, and that was it. That was my voice. I had found my voice, because I think every one of us has a voice there somewhere, either a singing voice or for some instrument, and we're really lucky or blessed, actually, if we can find that
voice. If you
can
find it, that's right. Sometimes you can't.
Sometimes you can't.
People are searching for that, and
That's right. I felt lucky, I think, even then. Oh, my gosh, this voice worked as hard as I could. I used to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and practice, and I really wanted to play. And that it was when I was 12 years old that I sat down with my parents and I said, I think I really want to do this. And this was a time when women were really not in orchestras. Right. And that was the path I had chosen. I really wanted to be in an orchestra. And even being a professional musician for a woman was just risky business. But they said, we believe in you, which is the greatest gift a parent can give to a child, a young person. And we'll support you. And because they knew, being artists themselves, they knew what the struggles would be, but they knew what the joys would be too, and they wanted that for me. It's so wonderful.
And you went to college where?
First, the University of Southern California, which had a great music
program. Yes, it did.
And then Julius Baker was in town with the Bach Aria Group, and so Mitchell Lurie, the great clarinetist who was teaching at USC then, they were friends, so he took me over and had me play for Julius Baker. Right. And so I played for Julius Baker, and he said, you have to come to New York. You have to come to Juilliard. And I started crying. I said, oh, no, because I had a really terrific boyfriend at USC, a trumpet player, and I didn't want to leave him and go to the big city, you know.
Of course, Julius Baker at the time was principal flutist for many years in New York Philharmonic, right?
That's right. And he was teaching at Juilliard.
That's right.
So there I was, Juilliard. It was so cold. I mean, you know, if you're raised in California, born in Tennessee, I didn't know you had to wear socks, you know.
Well, you don't have to, but you're going to be a little chilly. Subway's not real good.
True.
Socks. Right. So you're in New York with no socks, studying at Juilliard. And we won't necessarily discuss the dates, but suddenly your career began to take off, and you really, I mean, it's been more than 4 decades of performing.
Yes, it has.
And so how did it start off? Did you go to an orchestra first, or did you go into the solo You know, some people start with an orchestra and then get kind of frustrated and want to branch out and do different kinds of literature and experience, and others just go right on into the kind of the solo career. So what was your path?
When I was young, I was training to be in an orchestra because that was the ideal of most young wind players.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And my idol was William Kincaid, also then Dorio Anthony Dwyer when she won the first chair position in the Boston Symphony. Then I started studying with Marcel Moise, and the idea suddenly of figuring out myself how I wanted a piece of music to go, and also playing with other people, a small group of people that would be chamber music, where everyone decides this together. This was started to become quite appealing to me. And at around that time, Jean-Pierre Rampal started coming to this country and playing recitals. Yeah. And I would go to them and listen, oh my gosh, this is really exciting and wonderful. And listen to this repertoire. I didn't know it even. Then I discovered the Schubert Introduction and Variations for Flute and Piano, and I started listening to Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau singing the Schöne Mohren and thinking, oh, this is a great piece of music. This is not just a silly piece. This is a very important piece. And look at all those Bach sonatas. And suddenly I thought, well, I'm going to give this a try. And I had no role models. I had no one to whom I could go and say, well, how do I do this thing?
Right.
What's my career path? Where should I go first? So I thought, okay, I'll just go and enter every competition I can see. And there weren't any, because at Juilliard, the concerto competition did not include wind instruments. It was only for violin, voice, and piano. Same with most of the competitions. Yep. Every once in a while, though, there was one. And then I went to Europe, and there was the Geneva competition, Munich competition. And then I came back to the United States after having won both of them, but no manager wanted to take me because there were... The tradition in orchestras was for the first flutist to play the concerto, not for some upstart to come out and do it. No matter that upstart person had been spending her whole life learning the repertoire and to do that. So it was really a struggle. And I've said this often, but I think I chose the road less traveled. It wasn't the road that was a clear path ahead of me. It had lots of sticks and stones and fires and floods. And so I had to pick my way through sometimes and just pick myself up and say, okay, start again. Pick yourself up, brush yourself off, all over again.
I think that there's a glass ceiling in a lot of professions, and we think of it as upward mobility in business. But it very definitely was true in terms of the stigmatization of where people could perform and what men did and what women did not do. And Carol Jantsch, first female major brass or tuba player, an alum here, just won the Philadelphia Orchestra a couple of years ago. And we said she broke the brass ceiling. Women don't play tuba. Well, of course they play the tuba. And so there are these stereotypes that you would think in our quote-unquote liberated society, but they had to be, they were there. It was just part of the process, really part of the old kind of the studio system of how the apprentice model, and men would study with men and women would only play certain instruments, but not necessarily in public. It was a very different time.
Yes, it was a very different time.
Very different time. So.
In a way, it was a very exciting time because there were a lot of frontiers. There were a lot of open space to be discovered.
Right.
And so I had a lot of fun with that, too.
Well, really, and we changed as a world. The whole kind of women's rights movement began in the 70s, and you were there at the right time.
I was. At the same time, I did want a family. I didn't want to do that. So I had to figure out a way to combine those two things. It wasn't as though I was doing one or the other. Yeah. Sometimes I think it's almost necessary to do one or the other. Except that men have really come around these days. Yeah. Men are becoming fabulous fathers.
Right.
You know, really willing to spend as much time with their children as the mother. Right. So it's possible to do it more now.
We'll talk about your advice for young players in a little bit. So we're gonna come to some famous moments. So I'm really curious to hear what some of those would be. But in the meantime, we've got a little Bach we're going to listen to.
Mm.
You want to go to the Magnificat?
Yeah, let's do that. Because I would say if I were on an island by myself, I'd have my Bible under my arm and I'd be thinking Bach a lot of the time, praising God for being alive and in gratitude. And so Bach's been so much a part of my life in that way. And this is such a radiant piece.
Yeah, the beginning of this is incredible. So this is the beginning of the Bach Magnificat, here performed by the English Baroque soloist and the Monteverdi Choir, conducted by John Elliott Gardner. Thank you. Well, from Bach, we're back to the island with our guest today, Paula Robeson, internationally known flute performer. I'm always curious when people have these wonderful careers that they've had and you're continuing to have, but, you know, 4 decades of incredible musical moments. What are 2 or 3 that just, to you, were transcendent experiences? Just wow.
Well, one of them was what happened very early on when I was 20 years old, and when Leonard Bernstein asked me to come and play the Carnival of the Animals with the New York Philharmonic, and then to afterwards record it. And what's funny about the recording is they gave me 1 take to do Volière. 1 take. They said, okay, Miss Robeson or Paula, okay, play. That's fine. Thank you very much. Like, oh my gosh, I'd like to do that one again. But that's the one that stuck. But the idea of just playing, working with him.
Right.
And he was just such a marvelous musician, artist, everything. Another great one was working with Michael Tilson Thomas, who's one of my just great friends, family, really, and doing the first performance of Leon Kirchner's music for flute and orchestra, which was written for me, and with Michael, who has such an amazing spirit and mind in the way he understood the piece. Mm-hmm. And we played it once, and then somebody had made a mistake in the orchestra sort of towards the end of the piece. We walked off stage, and he said, let's do it again. So we went out and we played the whole thing again. It's only about a 13-minute piece. But that was so wonderful, you know, that kind of moment. Then another one of my great experiences personally was working with Rudolf Serkin. When he wanted to play, he asked me to play the Schubert variations with him at Marlborough. Marlborough, the whole experience of Marlborough, I could say all of it was a kind of peak experience. But being with that man, rehearsing with him, seeing him before a performance, and seeing how an artist like that, because I was quite young also then, prepared for the performance, how he got so quiet and went inside himself. And he suddenly looked up, and I was looking at him. He said, you've never seen me like this, have you, Paula? Because he was such a passionate, you know, he worked everything about him was like this. And then that he was in himself so much. Just also the actual performance, being carried along on that immense flood of energy playing with him. Those are classical music experiences. Also, I think playing in a performance of the St. Matthew Passion, which Blanche Moise conducted, I'll never forget that. But one of the most fun things for me was, one of the great loves of my life is playing Brazilian music, and I've had been lucky enough to play with some marvelous artist, Romero Lubambo, who's just an extraordinary guitarist, and Ciro Baptista, who's a great percussionist. We had a trio for many years together. But we were in Carnegie Hall, and we were playing in a whole evening celebrating Bossa Nova. And we were playing a choro, which is called 1-0. It's a 1-0. It's like a soccer match. It's by the great composer Pixinguinha, who wrote a lot of great choros. Mm-hmm. And it's really fast, you know, and it's just banging things, and it's like guys bumping up against each other in a soccer match. We played that piece so many times, and people would cheer and everything. We played it mostly for Americans, but that audience was filled with Brazilians.
Sure, absolutely, New York.
So the minute we started, they started cheering. And I felt like we were the Beatles, you know, like, oh, we were up there playing this. And sometimes I remember the Beatles complaining, we can't hear each other. You know, and it was the same thing last. We almost couldn't hear each other because they were cheering so loud. And Carnegie Hall, which is just fantastic. I mean, playing in there, that's my favorite place in the world. It just reaches out with big arms and embraces you. And so to have that flood of sound coming towards us, too. That's something I think I'll remember when I'm old and gray and full of sleep.
I bet. And probably many, many more memories beyond that. And and more to come. But
I hope so.
But they leap out, you know, in terms of those truly moments when the music transcends and becomes almost spiritual in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Both in terms of fun and in terms of this year. Movement to another level.
The movement. Right? There was one I remember playing. My father had passed away, and none of us had heard that he was okay. You know, sometimes you get a signal from someone. Mm-hmm. Everyone else in the family had seen a star or felt that his presence was somewhere blessing them. And I was playing. I was on the stage of Alice Tully Hall, and I was playing the B minor Bach Sonata, the second movement, which has, it's like a Cicciolano sort of largo, and it has a repeat. Each movement had a repeat. So I was playing the first part, and I almost felt like I was asking him, "Are you okay?" And then as I was playing the second part, I felt this, that he was.
Yeah.
And then I played it again, asked the second part, and then I got my answer. It was really, that was overwhelming, actually.
Well, you talked about the Beatles who couldn't hear themselves, and that's actually the next piece you went, no, we're going to do Count Basie, aren't we? Yeah.
Well, why don't we do the Beatles?
Well,
next?
Let's do the Beatles. And you were very specific, two songs, Hard Day's Night or Get Back.
Get Back, Loretta!
But you decided on Hard Day's Night. We're all products of the Beatles. We're aging ourselves here, but they were a liberating group in their own right, weren't they?
And they were so good. Yeah. They were so good.
Innovative.
Innovative. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah, and so full of energy, good energy.
Well, here it is, Hard Day's Night.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel alright. You know I work all day to get your money to buy a thing, and it's worth it just to hear you say you're gonna give me everything. So why on earth should I moan? 'Cause when I get you alone, you know I feel okay. When I'm home, everything seems to be right. When I'm home, feeling you holding me tight, tight, yeah. It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog.
Well, from the Beatles and Bach on to other influences. You know, you talked about you love to play Brazilian music, and I know you've had experiences with jazz, and you brought some jazz. We'll listen to that in a minute. But today, players have to be so eclectic in their knowledge of the world of music, and it literally is the world of music. How did that, in the process of your career, how did that become different in terms of the different kinds of music you had to know and understand? And then you have to understand the cultures and the composers and the influences and the rhythms. Tell us a little bit about that, with a lifetime of performing, because you haven't just put your stamp on the Bach B minor mass or the flute sonata, right? Gorgeous as it is, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess I always was curious, and my family also. My parents were very socially, social activists. They were very much aware of other cultures within our culture, because if you think, I was a young person in the 50s and 60s, people tended to be isolated in groups. This was still when there was segregation in the South. My father taught at Fisk University, which was an African-American college. That's why I was born in Nashville. He was very much aware of that, how important it was to start the melting pot really melting and mixing. And so as a young person, I heard Paul Robeson was my godfather, so I heard him singing, and he sang about the world. He sang in many, many different languages. He sang about people, and Pete Seeger singing about people living together in peace. The dream that we are still dreaming, because we seem to still get ourselves into wars somehow. It seems to be our pattern, but the hope for peace is always there. So I guess I've always felt myself a citizen of the globe, even though in those days we were in our individual countries, now we are so mixed. So I find that the influences that come for artists now from all around the world, they're blessings. There's one blessing after another. We're hearing, we have such ease of communication with other cultures. And so world music, we're really all world musicians. If you think, too, that a composer like Mozart or Beethoven, who was living in Europe at a time when Europe was in flux, there were people coming through, there were conquerors, there were other cultures mixing a great deal in Europe. And so their music is full of, if you listen to the Brahms G minor piano quartet, and you hear Hungarian music in there. He was fascinated with the music of Hungary. And if you listen to the Brahms clarinet quintet, and you hear how many influences from other cultures are in the music of Brahms, because he was curious too.
Right.
He was listening too. So I think it's just an enlargement of what people have always been doing, who have open ears, who are just aware of their surroundings. Right. There are many more techniques of playing now, if that's maybe part of the question you were asking me. The extended techniques that are available to specifically flute players, let's say, for now, I have dabbled in it. I've gone a little bit into it. I love playing the Berio Sequenza, which was one of the first pieces to have multiphonics. And I've played Takemitsu, which has a lot of multiphonics. But farther than that, I'm leaving it to the young folks to do. And there was a young player who played today in class. He played Greg Patillo, a beatbox flute piece.
Yes, I've heard that.
And it's just great. And I'm thinking, great, play it. And I'm going to love listening to it. And I want to now be, because I think museums are living places. That's because the origin of the word is that's where the muses are. That's where they live. And so I want to preserve the vitality of the music with which I was raised and see if I can keep the music that was written for my instrument alive, and also pass on the things that many people who have passed on now talk to me. I mean, Pablo Casals, I worked with him at Marlborough. I heard him say, music, I can hear his voice saying it right now, music. Actually, as I get older, I'm able to imitate him better, which is a little disconcerting. But for me to be able to say, okay, he was like this, he looked like this, he walked like this, that. So I can actually be able to be a transmitter of my own memories are. I guess that's how I'm thinking of what my role should be right now. As an aging person.
Well, you've brought one of the great
always
classics.
Juvenile.
That's
though.
Right.
Always
there we go.
Juvenile.
One of the great classics that we'll always remember, Count Basie, which has set a standard.
Yeah, I was lucky to be in New York in the 60s when jazz was being played all over the place. So I went, and another boyfriend took me to hear Count Basie. So I was able to sit there and listen to him and watch him, smile, and listen to Little Darlin'.
You're listening to Island Cabin Discs on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Jeff Kimpton, your host, and my guest today is Paula Robeson, internationally acclaimed flutist currently on the faculty at New England Conservatory. That's the great Count Basie, Little Darlin'. The traveling life of musician. You know, different orchestra, different halls, plane flights, weather, food. How do you keep the consistency as a performer, as a world performer?
You know, through storm, through all dark of night, I feel like the postman, you know, always have to deliver the goods. Yeah, it's a challenge because I've never really enjoyed traveling too much. I don't like some people really love the traveling and the adventure of it, but I always get kind of nervous when I have to get to the airport and I always get there too early. And so that's why I've read so many books. Mm-hmm. I take so many books along with me. And the traveling is stressful, especially now. It used to be a little bit easier.
Yeah, it's tough.
Now that there's so many people in the security and all of that, it's just extremely stressful and we're packed into small planes. Unfortunately, my career was not of the type where I could have my own private jet or I can always travel first class. Sometimes I can travel first class, sometimes not. But I'm at the age where it would be really nice to be able to do that all the time. The private jet, I think, would be the best way.
I'm with you.
Yeah. But the thing is that what I've always thought is my mission is to get to the place and make the best music that I can. Mm-hmm. And so it sometimes means, I'd love to go and see that, go to that museum. Then I say, no, you're here to make music. This is why you're here. You've come to communicate something through your voice of a composer. And also to make music with whatever people you're going to encounter. And so sometimes I've played with some marvelous orchestras and conductors with whom I've had a great affinity. One of them was Don Yeager, by the way. I played with it when he was conducting out in California. Played with him years ago. We were laughing about that, how many years ago it was. And sometimes the orchestras were not so good, but I always thought, still, the thing is to make music. And I think any musician would say the same thing. Even if you're playing to a hall full of people, even if there's only one in the whole hall whose life has been changed by your music, then that's the reason you're there. Right. I believe that there's a difference between art and entertainment. They're both wonderful. Entertainment is really important for our lives because to be entertained is part of art. Entertainment is part of great art. If you listen to any great French Baroque composer, the purpose of the music was to stir the emotions and have something that's charming and pleasing to the listener, right? And entertaining, if you go to hear a good singer, you go to hear a show, and you're being entertained, you're basically passive. You're sitting in your seat. You're letting something come to you. And basically, you leave being the same person that you were when you came, but you're probably happier. You're feeling more relaxed. Mm-hmm. You're feeling better about your life. You're refreshed. You can get back to your life, get back to work, because you've been taken to a place which is really fun and happy. But art, although it can contain that process, also sometimes makes you very not happy. Mm-hmm. It makes you scared, you know, it makes you
think.
Yes, it makes you think. Mm-hmm. It makes you concerned. It makes you shaken. It makes you cry sometimes or remember something that happened to you. But the most important thing is that it does change you.
Right.
Great art, you are a different person when you leave a place where you've been in contact with great art than you were when you came in.
Well, you talked about voice and great art, and here we come to Elizabeth Schwarzkopf.
She's an artist who has just meant everything to me for my whole artistic life, because she's an artist who took chances. She had a beautiful voice, but she would go to places that other singers just didn't want to risk going to. Right. And the song we're going to listen to now, Waldseligkeit, the words are, I am sitting in the woods, I'm by myself, I'm alone with the trees, but I am not alone because my heart is yours. She's speaking really to her lover. And the way she uses her voice in this song is just the most extraordinary thing. Leaps of octaves, sustained tones, just beautiful. And George Zell with the orchestra.
Wald, wie
That's one of the great sopranos of all time, Elizabeth Schwarzkopf. There in Waldseligkeit by Strauss with George Zell and the Vienna State Opera Orchestra. You must have some challenges you want still left in your career. Are there some things you really want to do, some music you want to record or commission? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, yeah. Here I am. I'm getting old, and I said to my husband a couple of years ago, this is it. I'm going to stop playing the flute now because, you know, I just want to be a teacher and play well enough to demonstrate at lessons. And he said, oh, okay, if you want to do that, okay. And I did that for a little while. And then one day he said to me, Paula, you are in such a bad mood. You go and get your flute out of that case and practice. He's such a marvelous man. So I got it. It was kind of a renaissance. It was kind of a renewal, mm-hmm. which involved going back and thinking, why do I do this anyway? You know, when I was young, what were my dreams? Right. Why am I doing this? So I had to rethink it. Why do I play the flute? Why did I choose the flute? You know? So then I started playing and going back to what my teacher said, the old etudes that I used to play. And then I decided I wanted to become a really good teacher myself. So I want to, this summer, I'm setting aside a good deal of the summer when I get home. And we've been in conversation here at Interlaken with my colleagues. I want to really know how to help my students more. Mm-hmm. And also, a young pianist, this is so wonderful when it happens to an old lady. A young pianist came up to me, Pavel Jumpanen, his name is. He's a Finnish pianist, yeah. Fantastic pianist. And he said, Paula, you know, I want to learn the Boulez Sonatine. Did you ever play that? Now, this is a piece which was written in 1946. One of the first, just great, way out there, difficult pieces for flute, which I, through my whole life, would go, this is the year for the Boulez Sonatine. Well, maybe next year. And I still have the copy I bought all those many years ago. He said, I said, no, I've never played it. He said, okay, you should learn it. We're going to learn it together. And I said, what, we are? And he said, yes, we are. We're going to do it. I said, okay, we are. We're going to do it. And so I'm learning it. And it's so hard. It's so hard. But it's so good for my brain, you know, because it's so challenging. One of my students gave me the fingering for the high F, which ends it. I've never played a high F in my life. Now I can play one. And we're playing it two places. We're playing it in New York and Boston in September. And in August, we're going to have a Boulez boot camp. We're going to rehearse every day, all day for 2 weeks. So that's what I'm doing. Yes, I do want to record some more.
Sure.
There's still some stuff like the Boulez, which I've never recorded. There's some kind of standards of the repertoire I've never recorded. I'd like to do a couple more.
All this new music.
Yeah, all the new music. Yeah, there was so much great music.
I heard the Chicago Symphony last year, and that wonderful flutist from Chicago who was in L.A. for a while and then left and went back, played it to French composer. But it was a new concerto that I can't remember the name of it, unfortunately. But it was so interesting, and I wanted to hear it again because, I missed this. What do you do here? And you have the time to do that. So
This is what's happening. Composers are now writing pieces which are, yes, intellectually challenging, but they're accessible. You can get enough of it on first hearing that you really do want to hear it again. You're not antagonized by it. It's really great.
Probably the work of Chopin was that kind of. I'm the master of segues today. You were very clear that you wanted to hear Rubinstein playing Chopin.
My man.
Right. And why? How does he speak to you?
Ah, gosh. Luckily I was able to hear him play many times. The joy that he had.
Rubinstein, that is not Chopin.
Not Chopin. No, dear. No. No, Arthur Rubinstein. He was kind of an idol in our family when I was growing up. My father had his recordings of the nocturnes. We would always play those. And so I grew up listening to him. And then I was able to not only hear him and see him, watch him play. And the kind of relaxation that he had at the keyboard, because he so much loved what he did. The hands relaxed on the keyboard helped me so much with my flute playing. And I use it with my flute students also. That the fact that the body is so relaxed and the joyfulness, so that the music just comes pouring out of him. And the fact that when he plays a mazurka, you want to dance to it. The dance, it's so much in the basic, the inner rhythm of the dancing.
He caught the life
of
that.
Chopin, yes, he did. Right. Chopin they probably all danced the mazurka. They're all Polish, you know? when Rubinstein plays, when Rubinstein plays Chopin, the whole world is Polish.
That's the great Artur Rubinstein doing the Chopin Mazurka number 4, F minor, opus 68. Paul, this has been an absolutely amazing time. We could talk on here for hours. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. I want to know what your choices would be. Well. That's for the next one.
That's for the next one. I've actually done my own program, which was kind of fun. But when we talked about a closing piece, you got written on this piece of paper that you gave me down at the bottom in big letters, Dean Martin. And we kept saying, well, maybe we don't have time for Dean. You said, oh, no, we got to do Dean Martin. And you were very specific, Christmas blues.
Yeah, because I would get the blues and want to go home at a certain point in that summer on
that's
that
right.
island, and I'd want Dino to take me back there in his boat. So
Paul Robeson, great to be here. Thank you. Thank you. And out with the Christmas blues.
Thank you.
The jingle bells are jingling. The streets are white with snow. The happy crowds are mingling, but there's no one that I know. I'm sure that you'll forgive me if I don't enthuse. I guess I've got the Christmas blues. I've done my window shopping. There's not a store I've missed. But what's the use of stopping when there's no one on your list? You'll know the way I'm feeling when you love and you lose. I guess I've got the Christmas blues. When somebody wants you, somebody needs you, Christmas is a joy of joy. But friends, when you're lonely, you'll find that it's only a thing for little girls and little boys. May all your days be merry, your seasons full of cheer. But till it's January, I'll just go and disappear. Oh, Santa may have brought you some stars for your shoes, but Santa only brought me the blues. Those brightly packaged, tinsel-covered Christmas blues.
My guest today was Paula Robeson, internationally acclaimed flutist currently on the faculty at New England Conservatory. For more information about the music you've heard on Island Cabin Discs, go to ipr.interlochen.org and click on Island Cabin Discs, or write to us, ipr@interlochen.org, and refer to the program featuring guest Paula Robeson. I'm Jeff Kimpton, your host, thanking you for being with us today. The executive producer for Island Cabin Discs is Tom Paulson, and this edition of Island Cabin Discs was produced by Brock Mormon for Interlochen Public Radio.